Welcome to Third Culture Therapy, a podcast that looks at the unique ways our social identity and cultural heritage impact our mental and emotional well-being. I'm Leila Magribi, writer, journalist, and host of this show. In this series, I'll be exploring how our multiple and sometimes conflicting identities affect how we feel about ourselves and the world around us. Through interviews with people from various backgrounds, I'll be delving into the vastly different journeys taken in the pursuit of inner wellness and find out what aspects of their culture have had a positive and maybe negative impact on their mental health. Welcome to the show, my dear listeners. I'm really excited for you all to listen to my conversation with the author Leila Al-Ammar. In this chat between the two Leilas, you'll hear us talk about the writing process, how trauma reveals itself in literature, the existence of a common Arab wound, its socio-political origins, and its contemporary impact on our emotional and mental states of being. I'm a big fan of Leila's work and the way that she thinks, and I'm pretty confident that you will be too. But let me start off with giving you a little more background on who she is. Leila Al-Ammar is a writer and academic from Kuwait, where she grew up. She has a master's in creative writing from the University of Edinburgh and recently completed her doctorate in literature on the intersection of Arab women's fiction and literary trauma theory. She has written for several literary publications, and her short stories have appeared in the Evening Standard, Quail Bell magazine, the St. Andrews University Prose Journal, and Aesthetica magazine, and she has been nominated for a number of creative writing prizes. She was the 2018 British Council International Writer in Residence at the Small Wonders Short Story Festival. Her debut novel, The Pact We Made, was longlisted for the Authors Club Best First Novel Award, and her second novel, Silence is a Sense, about the day-to-day trauma response of a Syrian refugee in the UK, was shortlisted for the William Saroyan International Prize for Writing. I personally found Silence is a Sense a mesmerizing work, a beautiful writing and deep emotional intelligence. It was a difficult read and I took my while with it, slowly absorbing the depths of emotional and psychological scarring she reveals in her characters. As an Arab and a part Syrian and someone who has had family who fled the war to become refugees in Europe, I found it especially poignant and painful, but it was beautiful nonetheless. Leila, thank you so much for joining this podcast. I have to admit, I am a massive fan. I was even before I met you. And then when I did meet you, I had a very big fangirl moment and it hasn't stopped.
Me too.
Your writing is so beautiful and it's so deep and just rich, multi-layered, so thoughtful. And both books, so I started actually with Silence is a Sense, your second, and then I went back and read The Pact We Made. Both are great books, and both touch very much on trauma and psychological pain. And I suppose I want to ask you why, obviously it's also the topic of your doctorate, why this interest, where did it come from in exploring trauma and trauma theory in your writing?
Thank you, first of all, for having me on. This is a really wonderful opportunity to talk about an important topic. It's a topic I've been interested in for a very long time, and I would say that I've been reading about trauma and recovery and memory my entire adult life, so for the last 15, 20 years or so. And I think, you know, for me, it grew out of a curiosity about people. Initially, about the human condition, about the psyche, about the processes of memory, being, the self, identity, all of these were questions that I was really fascinated by the entire time that I was growing up. And I think that for a writer, that's kind of natural, you know, to be curious about people and what motivates them, what drives them, what disrupts them in some way, and how they process that. And so, you know, I was always reading about Freud, and Judith Herman's book, Trauma and Recovery, was an important one for me early on. And, you know, all of that just kind of developed and developed in reading about memory and cultural memory, collective memory, how those intersect with personhood and individuality, you know, what the tensions are there. And so it just kind of developed along those lines. And it seemed natural to me that when I started writing novels, that that's also the subject matter that I would deal with, because it's what was driving my curiosity anyway. And then that kind of fed into the PhD as well.
You didn't start off a career as a writer, something quite different. So how did you get to the point where you were writing as a profession, and how did you find the process of actually writing your first novel?
It might have been Eudora Welty, that a love of writing comes out of a superior love of reading. And I've always been a reader ever since I was a child. For as long as I can remember, that's the thing that I do. I always have a book. I'm always reading. And so naturally, I think when you read a lot, you eventually want to try writing. So I've also been writing since I was very young, probably 9 or 10 years old. But it was always kind of a hobby more than anything else. I never considered it as something that I would do even semi-professionally. Growing up in Kuwait as well, the liberal arts, the creative industry wasn't really something to be seen as a career option. I went to public school. There were no creative writing courses on offer. When I went to university here for my undergrad, there was no creative writing on offer. Things are different now. But back when I was growing up, it wasn't an option. And so I kind of took a more traditional path, I guess, in terms of going into business and economics and investments. And that's kind of where my initial career trajectory was going. But I wasn't satisfied with that, and I wasn't happy with it. And I developed quite a serious anxiety disorder in my early 20s as a result of all of this, and not feeling like I was fulfilled in terms of what I wanted to do and my passion. And so I just ended up quitting my job and went to get a master's in creative writing. And it was when I was doing my master's in Edinburgh that I first started to think about seriously pursuing writing in terms of trying to write a novel, trying to get an agent, get a publishing deal, you know, all of those things that I hadn't really considered as a serious option before. And my first novel actually grew out of a short story that I wrote during my master's. So it started life as a 5,000-6,000 word short story for the program. And then when I graduated, the characters just wouldn't let me go. And I felt like there was more to be told, and there was more of that character, Dahlia, to unpack.
That book, The Pact We Made, that's the book that it takes place, centers in Kuwait, your home country. And the characters, there's one main character, obviously Dahlia, but then there are three girls, right, that are these best friends who have, you know, it starts off with this pact, obviously, that they made, that they'll essentially like live the same lives, which is get married at the same time, have kids, you know, a narrative that we're all quite familiar with in the Middle East. But it's, you know, it soon transpires that Dahlia is quite different to the others. She hasn't, you know, she's at a later stage in her life, and unmarried. And then we come to discover that she's been a victim of abuse and trauma in her childhood, and how much that impacts and shapes her. And why did you choose that topic to go into, especially for your first novel? That's quite daring. But it's also really difficult, particularly in our part of the world. I mean, to be honest, anywhere in the world, talking about abuse, talking about violence against women, albeit so prevalent, is still very difficult to discuss, but definitely in the Arab world. So what made you decide that was going to be your entry point into the world of writing?
Yeah. You know, I always like kind of trip up on these words of choice and choosing and deciding. And that's not really how I approach my creative writing. I never sit down and say, right, this is going to be a novel about unacknowledged trauma. Let's go. Let's do this, you know, or for the second novel that this is going to be about the refugee crisis and, you know, the Syrian civil war. I don't do that. You know, my work is primarily character driven. And the reason is because I do just get a voice. I get a voice of this character, and I don't try and direct that voice at all. You know, I just kind of go with it. And really, when I start writing, I don't even know what the story is. I don't really know who these people are, you know, but I just kind of trust that voice and I go with it, and it reveals itself as I start writing. So, you know, by the time it transpires, like what her story is and what her past is and where she's coming from. And, you know, I start to get that picture in my head of, oh, this is what this novel is going to be about. This is what's at the core. At that point, I'm like, I'm too deep into it. And like, I'm in love with these characters and I'm in love with this story. And it feels like an impulse, like this needs to come out. You know, I think it's the point of literature is to agitate people and to speak about truths. And these are truths. We do live in these societies where there is a huge problem with unacknowledged trauma and shame and taboos and stigma and victim blaming. And all of this gets internalized. And I think we see that with Dalia in that novel, where she has internalized these ideas and it has compounded her trauma and her sense of internal instability and insecurity in terms of like this mask that she wears, where outwardly people see her in this way, but internally she knows that something else is going on and she's trying to reconcile that, you know, outward and inward life, I suppose. And, you know, and you know, beyond the individual trauma that Dalia's story encompasses, there are other like microaggressions and traumas that the book talks about, which are also, unfortunately, a problem in our society as well.
What you said about this internalized shame, and in both of them, it's very strong, that idea of it, of someone carrying silently the burden and the pains of whatever emotional, mental, physical suffering they're enduring. And that's, it's really strong. It's a really strong feeling that I was left with as a reader when I felt, because, you know, there is the trauma and that's one thing, but then the living with it alone and not knowing what to do with it and hiding it and the shame that surrounds it, which is a whole other trauma, I think, as well. Right?
Yeah, it is for sure. And, you know, as much as our societies and our culture is very communal and very collective in terms of the way we live, the way we see ourselves, the way we think of ourselves, but at times that communality also propels isolation, because there's so many knock-on effects of the words that you say. It's, you know, your words and your actions don't just stop with you. They impact those around you and those closest to you and those that you love, you know, and so there's an incentive to keep things inside. And that's aside from the fact of how much stigma still surrounds these topics. And as I said, the misogyny, the victim shaming and blaming and, you know, the lack of legal recourse at times. So it's like, well, why should I even say anything if nothing is going to come from that, you know? So I think that there are a lot of factors and pressures that propel a culture of shame and silence and reinforce it. And it can be hard as one person to kind of come out against that if you don't think that you're going to have allies or people who stand beside you or people who even want to hear it, frankly, at times, you know? I mean, there's a lot of incentive just to kind of turn away and say, this is not happening. The case with the silence as a sense is a lot different, obviously, because I'm not Syrian myself. I'm not a refugee. I don't have those kinds of experiences. And I was aware, you know, from the beginning, from when I got her voice in my head, and I realized about 10,000 words in or so that this is what the story is and this is who this person is. And at that point, I was really aware that, okay, this is a different undertaking to the first novel, and that I need to approach it in a more responsible way, I guess, in terms of being aware that this is not my story, that it's a reflection of the true stories of other people. And it didn't come out of nowhere. It's not like I got that voice and then I said, right, I'm going to sit down and research all of this. When I started writing that book, it was in the summer of 2017. And I had spent the better part of the decade. So from the start of the Arab Springs, I was completely absorbed in everything that was happening, and constantly reading about it and following events, and especially in Syria, because I think Syria, what happened in Syria is really a psychic wound on the Arab world that it's going to be very, very difficult to come back from. There was something extremely psychologically devastating in what happened with Syria. And I think a lot of people felt that when the situation really started to devolve into civil war. And then, you know, with the refugee crisis and all of the xenophobia and the nationalist sentiment that was rising everywhere, you know, all of these were issues and topics that I had been following for, like I said, the better part of a decade. And so when this voice came to me and I started writing the novel, it immediately clicked, where it was like, okay, all of this stuff that I've been reading about and watching and listening and paying attention to all got funneled into this character and into this novel.
You just touched on the fact that the Syrian war is such a big psychic wound in the Arab world. For me personally, my mother being Syrian and having a very strong attachment to the country, I know that I have been deeply emotionally wounded by it, but I can also speak to that because I have a very personal connection with it, and the losses are tangible. You know, I actually have lost connection with the country I used to go to all the time, family that I have there, people, you know, homes, etc. But I've also recognized that my pain has been shared more widely. And you just touched on that now. And can you explain a bit more what you meant by that, and how that, what sort of impact you're saying in terms of it reverberating across the region and probably for many years?
I mean, you know, anyone who follows me on Twitter or hears me talk about this, I'm a very strong believer in our shared Arabness and our identity as Arabs. And I think that our identity as Arabs predates our other identities. I mean, objectively, that's a fact. You know, we were Arab before we were Kuwaiti, before we were Syrian, before we were Lebanese or Jordanian, you know? And so I continue to be a believer in that sense of uruba in our Arabness, you know? And it's not, and I've said this before, it's not the Jamal Abdel Nasser pan-Arabism. You know, it's not that. It goes back further than that. It's about our culture, our turath, our sense of who we are as a people, you know, and what we share in that Arabness. It's in our language. It's in our frames of reference, our, you know, the food, the music, you know, all of these things that unite us. And maybe I shouldn't say unite us, because unity is a contentious topic. But I think that we can be similar without being the same. We can respect our differences in our specificities and our uniqueness, but still kind of rejoice in our commonalities and find solidarity and strength in our commonalities. And I think that, you know, that Arabness is, it pops up. You know, and it can't be denied. You know, we see it in, like, most recently we saw it in the World Cup, in the way that all of us were so excited about Morocco winning, you know, or how the Palestinian flag was raised at every single game. And, you know, these markers of Arabness do show up. You know, this marker of our sense of shared identity
does come up. It comes up in good times. Unfortunately, it mostly comes up with bad times, you know, and probably the seminal event is the Nakba of 1948, which Edward Said has written about extensively, obviously, but he wrote in this very powerful essay called Arabic Prose Fiction After 1948. And he wrote about the Nakba as a kind of a mutation or like a monumental enigma in the Arab world. Like it affected a rupture in our sense of ourselves as a people, as an Arab people. You know, so that's one event. And then we have 67. And then we have, you know, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait was another one. You know, this kind of these destabilizing events that happen in the Arab world, the Lebanese Civil War. You know, these are psychic wounds that reverberate outside of their bounds, outside of their limits, outside of their borders. When the August 4th explosion happened in Beirut, the way that the Arab world, you know, raced with medical aid and with donations and with this. And I mean, what is that if not a sense of Arabness? You know, why do we jump whenever anything is happening in Palestine? You know, why do we jump when anything is happening in Lebanon, if it's not because of that? So, you know, I think that the Arab Spring as a whole was one of those events where we kind of saw, I don't like saying pan-Arab, so I'm not going to say pan-Arab, but like an Arab-wide swelling of emotion that was very similar across different contexts, you know, where a lot of these protests were in protest of the same thing. We were all striving for the same changes. We all had the same aspirations. We still do. And I think that how Syria completely fell apart was a shock. And I think it will be a shock for a long time. And it's one that we still haven't really come to terms with and really kind of reflected on.
I mean, is there even time to? It feels like, as you were listing through the crises and catastrophes, and you really only touched on like a fraction of the ones I was thinking in my head. I was like, oh, and then there's that, and this one, and Algeria. You know, I share your feelings on Arabness, although I know that it is a bit contentious for some people, and you know, with rising nationalism, and there's this sense of like, no, I'm from this country. I grew up personally in a household that was very like Arabs, you know, it's like sort of this unity, albeit, you know, a bit of fractured unity for sure, politically, at least socially, 100%, you know? And so I always had that sense, and for me, there was no personal conflict in it. I really thought, well, of course we have this shared sense, and we're definitely, you know, better together and more powerful together. There's a lot, of course, that's beautiful about it, but I absolutely recognize on a personal level what a huge burden it is. And you touched on that, this psychic sort of trauma that reverberates. And it's not enough. It's not just about the one country I'm from having a problem. It's like whenever any one of them, and I feel it so deeply, so viscerally. And
I mean, we all cried on August 4th. Like,
yeah,
there is a human aspect to that where it's like, this is a human tragedy. So the human response is to feel for it. But there is an added dimension.
Yeah.
It's just by virtue of our Arabness and understanding like these compounded tragedies that we can't get out from under.
Exactly. It feels exactly that. You can't get out from under it, even if you're physically able to, even if you grow up in privilege like I have in England, far from it, it's always there. It's always there. And it's like this, just this shadow that refuses to, I suppose the shadow will never leave you, but it is there. And even when it feels like it's silent, and I caught myself sometimes in the most unexpected moments, like I'm really not prepared for it, and it just hits me, and I feel so much emotion and pain, you know, and sadness and heaviness. And I think, gosh, like, is this it? Is this, that doesn't really matter where you are, where are you going to go? Are we always going to have this? Is to be Arab to be traumatized? Like, is that it?
Yeah. Yeah. It does seem to be a recurring theme, which is why I decided to focus on it for my thesis. I think that we can trace this back as we usually can with the past. And a lot of trauma is about origins and about some fundamental rupture or something went wrong at the start. Like there's some sort of khalal, there's some sort of dysfunction that happened, like at the original point of it. And Fatma Mernissi, Moroccan writer, in her memoir, The Harem Within, she says, time is the Arab's wound.
Hmm.
I've been thinking about this a lot, and it kind of drives a lot of what's in my thesis. And it's this idea of like a rupture or a mutation or whatever you want to call it, that happened at the start of the Nahda, you know, and I call it a failed Nahda. And it's this kind of the result of imperial and colonial friction in the 19th century. And it kind of affected this rupture in our historic continuity as Arabs. And we understood ourselves as Arabs. And then there was this friction that happened with the West, and suddenly there was a break, and we were asked, you know, a large part of the Nahda project was about effecting a break with our past and leaving that behind because it's backwards. And we said it was backwards as much as anyone else, and kind of uncritically adopting Western models and European models of modernity and progress and this and this and that. But, you know, there's a consequence to that. There's a consequence to severing a people from who they've always understood themselves to be at a psychological level. And a lot of my thesis deals with the psyche, you know, at its most fundamental levels. And, you know, what we find is that a good part of that psyche, a good part of our psychological makeup is built up and made up based on the structures that surround us, based on the society that we are born into, based on, we call it kind of a symbolic order, this kind of whole structure of language and law and rules and society that surrounds us. And so, you know, this kind of rupture of the Nahda resulted in a kind of failed or schizophrenic modernity that is not true. You know, and Hisham Sherabi wrote a very important book on neo-patriarchy, where he talks about all of this. And he talks about how, you know, our modern Arab states are not modern. They are kind of a marriage of imperialism and patriarchy, where these kinds of old tribal ways of thinking and patterns of thought and habits, they were not done away with, you know, they were reinforced. And what happened was that we had this kind of like hybrid form of society that emerged, which is not really modern, but it's not really traditional. And it's kind of schizophrenic and hypocritical and, you know, prone to cyclical breakdowns. And he says in the book very clearly that these state formations do not function. They don't function as an economy, as a military structure, as a social structure, as a political structure. And he says they are prone to breakdowns and civil strife and war, everything that we've been seeing for the past 100 years. And so if we go with psychology or psychoanalysis, which says that the individual is created out of these structures, and if the structure is self-alienated and full of contradictions and hypocritical and schizophrenic, those are the kinds of people that are going to be produced out of that structure as well. And they're going to suffer and get caught in those cycles of trauma and strife, whether on a personal or political level, individual, collective level. You're born into this cycle and you're trapped in it, you know? But it all comes back to that failed Nahda, that kind of rupture that happened in our collective identity as a people. And
And that same thesis is remarkably consistent. You know, I mean, like Fathi bin Salama talks about it in terms of Muslim development, and the Moroccan philosopher Mohamed El-Jabri talks about it, and Halim Barakat talks about it. I mean, all of them have kind of identified this moment in our past as Arabs as being that kind of originary trauma moment, where suddenly we were faced with Western models that we had to either uncritically adopt or unthinkingly reject. But there was no sense of our own organic, autonomous development as a people. It was a rupture, and then we became something else.
Mm-hmm.
And that rupture is our trauma, yeah, that we're still repeating and reenacting.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. It's also, on the one hand, intellectually so enlightening and kind of like, oh, light bulb, great. Also a little bit depressing, because the idea of how do we, you know, the thought of how we kind of break with that cycle seems so impossible, particularly, I guess, and maybe it's, you know, one thing leads to the other, it's chicken and egg, when our awareness of traumas is so limited.
I mean, our understanding of trauma is adopted from the West. There's no getting around that. And that in itself is a perpetuation of that same Nahba problem, right? Is that instead of figuring out how to make modernity work for us on our terms autonomously, which is what Europe did, by the way, this is how they moved into modernity. It was not influenced by anyone else. It was organic and authentic, you know, where ideas were debated, discarded, built upon. We did not have that chance. And so from the beginning, it was this idea of let's just adopt whatever the West is doing. And then suddenly we're modernized and, you know, and we're just like them and we can catch up to them. But I, you know, I think that time has shown that that's not the case. And, you know, the mental health industry, or the language of trauma, is one of those, is one of the victims of that process as well, is that from the very beginning, psychologists were trained at the Sorbonne. You know, they were French trained for the most part. And then they came back to Egypt or to Damascus or Beirut or whatever, and put those ideas into practice. And, you know, there were some psychologists at the start who realized that this wasn't going to work. In the 50s, Yusuf Murad, an Egyptian psychologist, was one of those where, you know, he quickly realized when he came back and started putting his schooling into practice in his clinic, he realized that, hey, you know, this is not going to work. Like there is part of it that's useful for sure. But it needs to be adapted to us. It needs to be filtered through the way we as Arabs are created as social subjects, the way we understand ourselves, our particular struggles, our particular, history and perspective, you know? And so he set about doing that. Like he set about taking Freudian theory and finding ways to combine it with more indigenous thought. And he, you know, at the start, he was remarkably successful at this. And he had like the first Arab journal on psychology in Cairo, and, you know, had seminars and lectures, and, you know, people were putting this into practice in the clinic. It wasn't just a theoretical abstract discussion. But, you know, then the 60s and the 70s happened, and, you know, the political situations deteriorated and it got more authoritarian. And, you know, authoritarian structures are always going to be hostile to innovation and are more comfortable with just unthinking adoption of ideas rather than really innovating from within.
Would you say that is the in your opinion, the one of the big drawbacks or limitations of the culture that you come from, healing or understanding mental and emotional health, is the lack of language?
It can be. You know, language is a central question of trauma, and it always has been right from the start. you know, this idea that in order to process something or recover from it or heal from it, you need to be able to speak it. You need to be able to name it and identify it. And then there are those who think that that's not the case, and that that in itself is a very Western idea. And, you know, that there is something to be said for silence, and silence is a legitimate coping mechanism, you know, and that it is a legitimate coping mechanism for a lot of cultures around the world. So, you know, all of that has been kind of part of the decolonization of trauma studies, is understanding how other cultures cope with violent and extreme events, you know, and not thinking that the Western model of the talking cure is always the best model to go by. Sometimes it's not. But I think that it is to our detriment that we don't have our own terms for these things, you know, and even the literature that I've studied, you know, like Hanan Sheikh's Hikayat Zahra, the story of Zahra, is about...
I'm reading it right now.
You're reading it
halfway through.
Good luck.
I know. Really heavy. This is why it's taking me a long time. Every few days I read a chapter and then I'm like, oh my God, I need another week to recover.
It's intense. Yeah. It's one of the books that I study for my thesis. And I've done a comparison between the Arabic and the English translation. And, you know, there's so much to unpack with that book, but, you know, Zahra is this woman with profound mental health issues, you know, like, I mean, I call it a collapsing sense of personhood in this book, that we just watch it happen. And obviously the background is the Lebanese civil war, which plays its part as well. But you know, the point I'm trying to make is that even in that book, Bil Arabi, in the Arabic original, Zahra is referred to as having hysteria, as having a hysteric episode. We don't have an Arab term for that. And so Bil Arabi, it's transliterated as hysteria, where the person who's calling her that, Majid, her husband, obviously knows this term. You know, it's a Western term, and, you know, the Lebanese, you know, like Lebanese writers and intellectuals were obviously very, very influenced by intellectual movements in France and psychoanalytic movements in France. And so, you know, all of these terms would obviously be understood by them. But when you're adopting a Western term, you are implicitly adopting the historical, social, political, cultural context of that term, and the context that compelled that term to be coined in the first place, you know? And so all of this baggage behind that term is being implicitly imported into a context where it doesn't necessarily belong. And that, I think, has consequences. You know, and you see that across the literature, like melancholia. We don't have an Arab word for melancholia,
despite 90% of the Arab world suffering from it.
You know, and
I don't mean to laugh, but it's kind of ironic.
You could probably make the case or the argument that we don't need a word for something that is so common. Why do we need a word for it? You know what I mean? Or something that is so normal that it was never kind of picked up as abnormal. And that's what trauma is. It was like when Freud started trauma studies or trauma theory, it was seen as this exceptional event, something that was out of the ordinary that happened to you as an individual, you know, and that sense of exceptionality of the event was one of the defining factors of trauma for so long. And now that, you know, requirement of exceptionality has kind of dropped away as the field has been decolonized, and there's been an understanding of insidious trauma, chronic trauma, systemic traumas. You know, these are things that don't meet Freud's requirement of exceptionality. And so that has kind of fallen away. But in the beginning, that's what it was. It was this idea of something unusual has happened, therefore we need to study its effects. But in situations where trauma is the norm, what is there to study? If you're undergoing the same trauma, your neighbor is, your cousins are, everyone is, what is there to name?
Indeed. I mean, I think that is in my mind one of the biggest drawbacks I find in the region of people improving their mental and emotional well-being. And something that was a little bit of a drawback even for me before I, you know, embarked on a journey of, you know, personal development and healing and therapy, and that sense of, oh, well, we're all going through it. I mean, I've heard it even, you know, my parents and relatives, and, oh, well, this is, you know, this is the norm. Like, we're all refugees or displaced or, you know, just lost. It can always be worse, you know, and now I stand up against it and say, no, that's not the benchmark. You know, that's not how I'm measuring life. And actually, we should be striving for more. And I find that that it's so difficult, but I also find it very disheartening. Like, it actually genuinely makes me really sad to think that that's now what's the accepted norm. And also, I think a huge barrier for people then being like, well, let me see if I can deal with whatever's going on and exit it.
The thing is that, like, because we were talking about how the psychotherapeutic models in our part of the world are inherited from the West, and they objectively do not work for the kinds of lives that we live and the kinds of histories and backgrounds. And, you know, you're talking about intergenerational trauma, transgenerational trauma, insidious traumas, you know, all of these things that the Western model, as it was imported, doesn't really account for. What that means is that, you know, therapy in our part of the world is little more than a drug dispensing industry. You know, if you talk to many people who have gone to therapy, myself being one of them, you sit there for 5 minutes, they push some drugs on you and they cycle you through up and down dosages for a few years because they're ill-equipped to deal with what the underlying issues are. You know, regardless of whether that therapist is an Arab or not, this is a training they've received. So they're not equipped to deal with the issues that you bring them. There's no blueprint for that.
What are the other ways that perhaps aren't the Western imported or medicated means, practices, philosophies within Kuwait or your culture, whether you identify specifically Kuwait or Arab, that do help?
You know, for me, literature has always been a good place for that, and a good place for finding solidarity, consolation, realizing that you're not alone. Someone else has felt this way before. Someone else has dealt with it before. It can backfire because you're like, you're reading something like you're reading now with Zahra, you know, which was in the 80s. And you're like, well, we're no better off now. And it's like 40 years later, right? And so it can be disheartening in its own way as well. But, you know, for me, the literature is important. For me, I think a lot of our sense of loss that you were talking about is an identity crisis, and it is trauma manifesting itself as an identity crisis, as a estrangement from ourselves. You know, in the last few weeks, I've been thinking about this term exile, ghurba, you know, which we sometimes call it exile, but exile doesn't really cover the resonance of the word ghurba, you know. And I think that we always, like with the word ghurba, we focus on this idea of estrangement, of the foreign, of the strange. But take that one step further. What does it mean to be estranged or in a foreign place or in a strange place? It's a question of security. There's a factor of insecurity in the word ghurba, you know, this sense of not being safe, you know? And so I think a lot of that is a sense of ghurba from ourselves. And, you know, for me, it comes back to the question of identity. It comes back to the question of language. It comes back to the question of our rupture from our past, of our turath, you know, and not understanding our heritage, not having assimilated it. You know, all of these factors, I think, you know, reconnecting with those things can go some way towards fortifying our sense of self, you know, and that fortification, it builds you up and gives you resilience and gives you a sense of confidence and security and being able to face traumas and catastrophes from that stronger standpoint would be helpful rather than facing those traumas without a sense of knowing who we are and understanding who we are and finding strength in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Gosh, so much, so much in that, so much that I felt really deeply. And I'm really glad for you that you found, I suppose, some of the answers, maybe not all, but some of those answers in the books that you've studied, in the literature, in the Arab women's fiction that you were studying. But I'm also incredibly grateful that you now are included among that cohort, and you're also offering that reflection and that insight because it's so needed. And yeah, I mean, look, it doesn't erase the pain, but it does make it so much more manageable. And like with most things, you know, just being seen and seeing yourself in others is so much a part of that. It's so much a part of the process. And there's so much work to be done on top of it. And we've just listed about 100 years minimum worth of work to be done. But, you know, it goes a long way.
There is value in understanding where we came from and understanding how we got here. Like I just gave a talk to some 18 and 19 year olds at a university here in Kuwait. And talking to them about this neo-patriarchy and our sense of Arabness and this rupture with our past and this discontinuity with our past. And it was just a sea of nodding heads, you know, and they were telling me, they were like, you know, we didn't know about these writers, you know, and I was talking to them about Ghada Saman and Hanan al-Sheikh and Nawal al-Sa'dawi and Fatma Mernissi and, you know, they study Sylvia Plath and Virginia Woolf and Simone de Beauvoir. And I'm not saying that those writers don't have value to offer. They do. You know, these are the writers that I myself grew up reading. But when you hear it from someone who comes from your culture and your society and who understands your perspective and who grew up in families similar to your families, the words have a different weight. They carry a different weight and they hit you differently. And you understand that you are a link. You are a point in this long line that stretches back, you know, and that in itself tells you that you're not alone, that you're not as lost as you thought you were, because there is this whole genealogy of women behind you who felt the same way and who understand where you're coming from and who took steps to rectify things, who wrote, who spoke out, who went to jail, who, you know, were murdered in cases, fighting these same fights that we're still fighting now. You know, there's strength in that. And, you know, there are probably answers in there that if we're all more aware of who we are and where we came from, you never know what dividends that pays down the line.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Check out the show notes for more details about my wonderful guests, including where you can find them on social media. If you enjoyed listening to this, please do spread the good word, share with friends, family, cousins, and colleagues, and please, please, please like and leave a review on whatever platform you are listening to this podcast. Your support is crucial for the show's success, and a couple of clicks from you will mean the world to me. Go to my website, leilamaghribi.com, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter for more news on future episodes.